From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Congresswoman-elect Alyssa Slotkin on preparing to go to Washington.
What I kind of wake up in the middle of the night thinking about, can we get things done when the environment in D.C. is so politicized? And that's our mandate, and that's our responsibility.
MSU shuts down its Nassar Survivors Fund. Therapists treating women sexually assaulted by Larry Nassar are left unpaid.
They don't want to re-victimize them by coming around and saying, oh, by the way, you owe me thousands of dollars. So it's a really tough position for the clinicians to be in.
Great Lakes Mayor is unhappy with new rules for the Great Lakes Compact.
Instead of strengthening the compact so that it would be harder for people to withdraw water, it actually allowed for the compact to be weaker in our estimation.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The incoming class of House Democrats looks like none other in the history of the U.S. Congress. The largest number of women ever elected to the House, 35. The first Muslim and Native American members, 22 people of color. The biggest number of veterans and members from the LGBTQ community. And this freshman class wants change. 46 of some 60 freshman Democrats sent a letter to their party leaders with a list of demands and recommendations. Representative-elect Alyssa Slotkin of the 8th District helped to write this letter and drum up support for it, and she's with us now. Representative-elect Alyssa Slotkin, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So before we dig into what's actually in this letter, tell us why you felt it was so important to speak out this way to House Democratic leaders.
Yeah, so I think no matter where we were elected, no matter where we ran, people came to Congress and Congress school, our orientation, with a really strong sense that they were elected on a mandate for change. Change for the country, but also change for the culture of Congress. And a bunch of us huddled together very early on in week one of Congress school and said, you know, the clearest way we can, you know, make our voices heard is by speaking collectively and getting folks together to talk about, first and foremost, some of the changes we think we should see within our own caucus, within the Democratic Party. And so that's what we did, and that was the intent.
And I know we'll start with things on the legislative agenda, and you're saying we have to heed the call from our constituents, and you're asking for priority action on immigration, gun safety, the environment, the cost of health care and prescription drugs, the infrastructure, criminal justice reform. Tell us, how did that list of issues get drawn up?
Yeah. So we, a bunch of the freshmen got together and we started to just exchange lessons learned. You know, how did you win and what was going on in your district? And what was very, very clear, particularly for folks who flipped districts, was that staying local, focusing on local issues, things that affect people's pocketbooks or their kids, were really, really important, more sometimes than the national, you know, Twitter conversation. And we just wanted to make the statement that legislation is our responsibility, and that while we will always serve as a check and balance on the administration, that is our job, that is our mandate, we also have a mandate to pass legislation, and that can't be lost in the sort of bubble of Washington. So that was what that was about.
Now, the letter to the party leadership, I'm looking at it now, was dated December 3rd. 4 days later, last Friday, came those new filings from Special Counsel Robert Mueller and the federal prosecutors from the Southern District of New York. And we all learned more about Russian interference into the 2016 election, possible ties to the Trump campaign. The SDNY linked the president to felonies his former lawyer Michael Cohen committed in connection with the 2016 campaign, with those illegal payoffs to the two women to keep quiet about alleged affairs with Mr. Trump. It was a lot, and we expect more. Can the House do both? Tackle all of those issues and investigate and oversee?
We have to. I mean, the mandate, you have to be able to walk and chew gum. You can't say that we only do legislation and ignore what looks like potential violations of the rule of law. And you can't just do investigations and not push forward with a positive agenda that helps people. You got to do both. And I got to tell you, just by spending time with this freshman class, everyone comes with a extremely strong background, you know, whether they were a federal prosecutor or a Navy pilot. And everyone feels like, you know what, if there's ever a class that can do both, walk and chew gum, it's this one.
Well, now that we're going to see Democrats like you in control of the House, what do you want to see happen with these investigations into the president, into his family, his associates?
Yeah, I mean, I want to see them play out. We are a nation of rules and laws, and we must always be a nation of rules and laws. That is fundamental. And so we need to move forward on everything and anything to make sure that we remain a country of rules and laws. So, you know, I don't know if that's always in the House. Sometimes there's just Department of Justice issues. There's legal issues that come way before a House investigation. But if there's an appropriate place for us to get engaged, we will. But for me, it doesn't obviate my responsibility to talk about health care and prescription drugs, to talk about infrastructure. Those things have to be going on at the same time.
I'm speaking with Representative-elect Alyssa Slotkin of the 8th District, who was very involved in writing and drafting a letter and spearheading support of the letter sent by many of the incoming class of House Democrats to their party leaders. And that letter calls for changes in internal rules, some housekeeping things. And what the one that really jumped out at me is bills must be available for review 72 hours before they can proceed to a vote. That would not have come from all of the what was rammed through with the tax bill last spring, would it?
It's not just that bill. It's a culture up there where people, you know, members of Congress are not expected to read the actual bills. Maybe they'll have a young staffer read through it. Maybe you'll get it a few hours before you're supposed to vote on it. And this new class just said, that's crazy, right? We've all worked as professionals before this. No one votes on something without reading it. So 72 hours, which seems like a pittance, is actually a big deal. And listen, this new class is already doing things, particularly around the schedule, that are changing the culture of Congress. We have the youngest class, the most women, the most people with school-aged children, and the most people with a dual-income families, two full-time working adults in the household. That's a very different Congress than 50 years ago. We've got to get home to our districts. We have responsibilities in our districts and at our own homes. And so we're really pushing to, you know, for the leadership to understand that we're a different class and you got to keep to a schedule.
And so how has the leadership responded to this letter, particularly Nancy Pelosi?
Yeah, so we're hoping for an official response. Actually, Leader Pelosi was the one who suggested that the freshmen would be a good idea for the freshmen to do a class. So, I mean, to do a letter, pardon. And so we're hoping for a formal response. Certainly, just in the first couple of weeks that we've been in orientation, you can see how the Democratic Party is changing. The freshman class is a quarter of all Democrats in the House of Representatives. So anyone who's worked in any organization knows you bring in a quarter of new people, that starts to change things. So the schedule, we've already been told that we're going to have new new expectations on scheduling. Even just this week with President Bush's funeral, the schedule got changed. We were all on our way back home to our districts on Friday after the final week of orientation, and all of a sudden we get a message. Literally, I was at the airport. We've scheduled a meeting for Washington on Tuesday. And all the freshmen got on a group text and a group email and started talking, are you going to turn around? Are you turning around? Don't you have stuff to do in your district? And I'm happy to say that on Tuesday, we will have the first ever phone-in caucus meeting for the Democratic Party so that you can call in from your district. It sounds small, but it's actually a big change for the culture of that place.
And speaking of leadership, speaking of Leader Pelosi, can you see any way to support her when that floor vote happens January 3rd to choose the speaker?
Yeah, you know, I have said for a long time now that I never want to be disrespectful to anyone who served, especially a woman who's broken glass ceilings. But I think we need to hear what people are telling us, certainly in my district. They want new leadership on both sides of the aisle. So I will not be supporting Leader Pelosi. I have told her that. We've had very positive conversations, and I'm going to work with whoever is elected speaker. And certainly it looks it's skewing that way right now towards her since there's no one running against her. But I think, you know, it's a very important to me to stick with my integrity and stick with my word on my very first vote on the floor. So that's what I'm going to do.
How do you respond to those who have said, and we've heard it a lot, this is not the time for rookies, not with what so many people see as an existential threat that's posed to our country through Russian interference, through corruption?
Again, there's no one running against Leader Pelosi, so I'm not sure who the rookie is in that scenario. Listen, the Democrats are a big tent. We pride ourselves on being a big tent. We have to be able to have deliberation and debate. That's a healthy thing. So I don't I don't believe that having a fulsome debate and a conversation about the future of the party is something that somehow hurts the party.
Do you think that being so clear with Leader Pelosi that you won't be supporting her, could that affect committee assignments or your ability to get things done for the people of your district?
Yeah, people have said that to me. You know, she's not going to do you favors, and you're not going to get some, you know, extra bonuses that you would get if you voted for her. And I just think that is exactly what people can't stand about Congress and about politics, is this idea of trading your integrity for favors. And I'm just not going to do that. That is not, to me, the way I'm going to start off. And to be honest with you, I have a hope and an expectation that Leader Pelosi is a very strategic thinker. She understands the importance of Michigan. She understands that we flipped a number of seats here. And I expect that she will put that firmly at the front of her mind when she's making decisions on things like committees.
Representative-elect Slotkin, what concerns you most about these next few years of Democratic control of the House of Representatives?
You know, I think that I am concerned that as we enter an election year for presidential elections, that our ability to actually get something done might be very limited. And I'm going to fight against that, and so is the entire freshman class. But you know, we are coming at this from a place where the world around us in Washington is hyper political and hyper vitriolic. And we all ran against that. And it's going to be up to us to band together, to stick together, to make sure that we can push through that and actually get something done. That, to me, is foremost in my mind of, you know, what I kind of wake up in the middle of the night thinking about. Can we get things done when the environment in D.C. is so, so politicized? And that's our mandate, and that's our responsibility.
Alyssa Slotkin, Democratic Representative-elect for the 8th District of Michigan. Thank you for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Coming up, Michigan is known for its craft beer scene, but that craft beer scene is decidedly not known for its diversity.
I've seen an uptick in people who are enjoying craft beer, but I've still yet to see an uptick in the number of black folk and people of color who are actually making craft beer.
After the break, we talk with two Michigan brewers who are looking to see more diversity in the craft beer industry. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Let's turn now to a conversation we recorded at our live show in Ann Arbor earlier this year. Take a listen. Here's a question to ponder. How white is craft beer? Writer Dave Infante posed that question in a piece for Thrillist. I'm going to quote him here. Craft beer is white, whiter than a ski lodge, whiter than a Whole Foods in the suburbs. And he followed it with a question, and again I quote, where the hell are all the black craft brewers, bar owners, bloggers, aficionados, and nerds? So we're going to talk about that as we welcome two guests who are changing that narrative. Brian Jones-Chance is chairman and chief operating officer of 734 Brewing Company in Ypsilanti, and Kuma Ofori-Mensah is a brewer at Cultivate Coffee and Tap House in Ypsilanti. Welcome to our stateside here in Ann Arbor. So good to have you here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So I want to start off with you, Brian. What's your answer to that question? How white is craft beer in Michigan?
It's pretty white.
Do you think the craft beer industry does have an issue with diversity?
I think it does, but I don't think it's necessarily anyone's fault. I think that part of the issue is that there are some maybe taste differences that aren't really fully being addressed, and that's a symptom of the problem.
What do you mean by that?
Well, if you don't have a lot of African Americans or any other minorities in the industry, then it's going to make it a little bit difficult to be sensitive to them when you're going to do marketing or creating recipes or any of the other things you might do.
And from where you sit, what do you think, Kuma, as far as has the black community been slower to pick up on craft beer?
I would say so. I've been brewing since 2012, and I mean, I've A joke I like to tell is I once went to a craft brewing conference at a ski lodge, and it was me and the Jamaican guy who worked there. But it's true. It's you don't see many people of color in the industry. I've seen an uptick in people who are enjoying craft beer, but I've still yet to see an uptick in the number of black folk and people of color who are actually making craft beer.
And why do you think that is?
On the craft side, on the creating side, I'm not 100% sure. I think in general, craft beer, culturally speaking, is not as appealing to people of color. I think it has to do with the fact that a lot of craft beer businesses are being started, operated, created by white people. Mm-hmm. And what that breeds is that you're going to have people who are creating a space, they're creating a culture, they're creating a business from what they know, from themselves. You know, it's just like anyone who starts a business, that's what you're going to do. And so I think what that ends up happening is you have a lot of spaces where, culturally speaking, it's not as appealing to people of color.
Has craft beer been linked to experiences and things that perhaps are not relatable or at all appealing to people of color? Is there a history in a sense, Brian?
Potentially. However, I don't really think that's where most of the problem comes from.
Okay, what do you think?
I think it has to do with cultivating a broader customer base. And if you don't have that broad customer base, then you don't have interest in the product. And when you don't have interest in the product, there's no interest in working in the industry. And then there's no interest in being an owner in the industry. And then you have problems where there's marketing that's not tailored to any particular demographic outside of the one in the mainstream. And I think that's really where most of the problem is. We can try to dice it up as being, you know, are there differences in taste or are there differences in environment? And yes, there are. The environment does need to be more tailored, but you can't get there if you don't have the participants, and that has to begin with customers.
You can learn a lot from people's stories. So I'm wondering what brought each of you to the brewing industry. I'll let you start, Kuma. What brought you to this?
For me, I actually went to school at Western, so I was out in Kalamazoo, and probably the best place in town to drink was at Bell's. And so I spent a lot of time just kind of going there, eventually expanded my interests. There were, at the time, Old Peninsula was another brew pub in town. When I went home to Plymouth, I was working summers at a place that had 800 different bottles of beer. And so for me, I was just kind of started getting interested in, like, how are there so many different varieties? I didn't, at the time, realize that there was so much variety. I knew there was variety in wine, but I didn't know that there was as much variety in beer. So I just kind of started tasting it, exploring it, and trying to find out, trying to learn. And then years later, eventually, I found myself a job in the industry.
Well, there you go. What's your story, Brian?
Well, like Kuma, and actually in the same years, we both went to Western.
Sure.
And
did you know each other then?
We did.
Yes.
Okay,
yeah. It's just coincidence. And my story started with my friend Patrick and I brewing our first batch of beer in a basement in the house that I was renting. We got all the supplies from Bell's. And it turned out all right. He really got into it and took off. I had other interests, and he outgrew his basement, and he got me and another friend to help him start the business.
So, and you opened, I know, Brian, 734 Brewing Company this past June?
That's correct.
What do you see as the mission of your place?
Our mission is to expand the reach of craft beer into underserved markets and expand the opportunities in craft beer to those same markets.
And how are you doing that?
It's kind of a three-pronged approach. So the first step is to remove the barriers and reduce switching costs. Barriers are easy, things like price. Switching costs are the things that make you grab the Heinz ketchup instead of the Meyer brand ketchup, even though it's 50 cents more. You have an association with it, and we want to bring that down. So one way is having good operations means that we can provide really good quality at a really low price. Our beers start at $3.25. Somebody drinking Bud Light on happy hour can definitely still afford it. And that's a high switching cost. If you're used to Bud, they've got a huge brand, and a lot of people of color are drinking those larger mainstream brands because it's what they know. Same with anyone else. Same with older folks. You bring that cost down, and suddenly it's something you can experiment with. You can try it. And once you try it, because it's good, you will keep drinking it. And that's where it starts. It's really that simple.
And Kuma, tell us with your job as brewer at Cultivate, what does that entail?
So my job actually is unique in that all of the brewing that I do is collaborative. So my job is to create partnerships with several breweries around the state, come up with recipes with those breweries and their brewers, and go out to the different breweries to create beers that we'll end up buying half the batch to put on tap at Cultivate as one of ours.
So through what you're both doing, are you making a concerted effort to speak directly to people of color?
Absolutely. One of the ways that we do that at 734 is the environment. It's very clean. It's very modern. There's no pallet wood anywhere. Not that there's anything wrong with that. But we do sort of eschew the hipster aesthetic. The other thing is the music, and that's a huge part of the environment. We mostly play hip-hop and R&B. It is not really a divisive kind of music. Everybody listens to hip-hop and R&B these days, and even our older customers have grown accustomed to acclimating themselves to youth culture for decades. It's not a big deal. They can enjoy it too. Everyone's welcome. That's really the main part, and the other thing is we find young people who are popular within these groups. So a lot of young artists of color present artwork there, and we have a little gallery set up. And we have young black musicians, young Hispanic musicians, young everybody musicians, really. And they draw their own crowd, which then gets them used to the space. They start trying the beer because it's inexpensive. And then they like it because it tastes better. And then they keep coming back. It's really not complicated.
Yeah. There you go. And Kuma, as somebody who designs and beers, give us an idea of some of these unique flavors that you've come up. What's the most unique one you've done?
Let's see. The most unique one that I've done. I literally just earlier came up with a day or two ago, came up with a recipe for a plum and cardamom wheat beer that I'll be brewing out in Grand Rapids next week. I've done a milkshake IPA that was made with mango, milk sugar, and a good amount of oats that went over incredibly well with a lot of people, pretty broad spread of people. I did a beer with Brewery Vivant that had honey, rose, orange flower water. I've done a cardamom and coffee beer in the past. All over the map. Yeah.
And Brian, what are some of your favorites that you offer?
Well, we take a slightly different approach.
Mm-hmm.
So we start people off on an apple wine that we make. That's pretty popular with people who are new to craft beer. If you don't like beer, and even if you don't like cider, this is good. It's not sweet. It's very dry.
Mm.
But for folks that are used to maybe going out and having a hard liquor drink, this does the same job, and it doesn't. It tastes okay when it's warm. And I think in particularly African-American culture, there is some aversion to public drinking. So doing it like at a family event out at a park, you might not be drinking. In a bar, you might have a mixed drink that you can nurse over a long period of time. This does that job. And then you move into the beers. We have simpler styles like our cream ale. It's a very popular starter beer. And then you can build on that into other flavors. Some people go from apple wine and cream ale, and now they only drink stout and IPA. The transition happened very quickly.
You're training taste buds.
We are.
Yeah, you're
and it's
totally.
It's really just a matter of introduction.
Well, both places sound absolutely fantastic with great offerings, and we want to thank you for sharing your passion for brewing with us. Brian Jones Chance, Chairman and Chief Operating Officer at 734 Brewing Company in Ypsilanti. Also in Ypsilanti, Cultivate Coffee and Tap House, where Kuma Ofori-Mensah is a brewer. Sound yummy? I'm going to be there checking them out. Thank you so
Thanks.
Much to both of you for being
thank
with
you
us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
The Great Lakes Compact Council is changing the way it reviews proposed water withdrawals and how its decisions can be appealed. But these newly announced changes aren't sitting well with Great Lakes mayors, native tribes, and environmental groups. Let's talk about why as we welcome John Dickert. He's the former mayor of Racine and now president of the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Cities Initiative. It's a coalition of 131 U.S. and Canadian mayors and local officials. Their goal is to protect and restore the Great Lakes and the St. Lawrence Seaway. John Dickert, the Compact Council consists of the governors and premiers of the Great Lakes region. What are the changes they announced last Thursday?
Well, the changes that they announced and we opposed were really dealing with trying to hold back some of the opportunities for the public to have their say on the changes that were going to be happening with withdrawals as they relate to the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence. The other thing was to add a new fee structure to people who were going to appeal any of the decisions on the withdrawals. There were a number of other items that are smaller items, but actually, instead of strengthening the compact so that it would be harder for people to withdraw water, actually allowed for the compact to be weaker in our estimation to allow applicants more access to the Great Lakes water, which we oppose.
Now, we on Stateside and on Michigan Radio covered that diversion request from the city of Waukesha that the council approved, which the mayors opposed, and it caused the mayors to demand a greater voice in the way diversion requests are handled. Do these changes at all allow for that greater say-so?
We withdrew our lawsuit in order to negotiate a better, stronger compact. And in essence, what we ended up getting was, well, first of all, we believe the mayors were ignored. And then the second piece is that they actually created a bill that weakened the compact in total. Now, when we talked about these issues, the thing that I brought up was that you took a proposal that was terrible and made it bad. And that's no reason to pass or move this through at this time. So we asked for a deferral, given the fact that the switch in the governors were from 5-3 Republican to 6-2 Democratic, which was pretty dramatic. One of the members agreed that it was a bad proposal, but they wanted to pass it through forward anyway. You know, we think that given the fact that we've had a dramatic sea change in leadership, coupled by the fact that this was a weaker piece of legislation, we thought this whole issue should have just stopped in its tracks, and they should have deferred this until the new governors are put in play. But unfortunately, that didn't happen.
And as you say, there are fees and there's changes in how these water withdrawal proposals are being received. I'm sure the council was asked why these changes happened. Did anyone explain the why to you?
Well, I think the first thing is that there was this strong baseline of only one public hearing should be held for each withdrawal application. And that's the first premise that we have a problem with, because the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence impact the 8 states and the 2 provinces, but they're only going to have one public opinion. They really never argued why that change was not made, other than the fact of saying if other people want to do it, they can hold a meeting on their own. That does not allow for transparency. The second piece, I think, and it probably is more important, is when you're having these public hearings, the public and the governors can hear not only the data and the testimony and the findings, but all the studies of how it will affect their community and other communities around them. That information is critical to us. And one of our arguments was that when new data comes out, because this is a process, when new data comes out, even if it's after the application, all of that data should be part of the summary brought to the governors. And that was even disapproved. So we have a real problem with transparency here, and nothing good happens in the dark of night.
And I know reporting about this is quoting Michigan's representative on the council, Grant Trigger, saying that failure to agree doesn't mean we didn't listen. He says the council is committed to keep on talking with stakeholders like the mayors, and that the council is committed to reducing concerns about withdrawals going forward. How do you react to that?
Well, first of all, we didn't see any of that. Compromise actually takes two people. And to simply say that since we were the lead organization that had this entire negotiation going in the first place, and the mayors were ignored on every aspect that they were bringing to the table, means that you may have listened but didn't hear. The second thing is both the mayors and the Anishinaabeg Nation both admitted that having a second meeting when the new governors are in doesn't give us any confidence whatsoever, given the fact that we weren't listened to the first time, that we would be listened to the second time. Now, we believe that the new governors may have a different look on this. The problem is you passed on to them a bad piece of policy. So for our mayors, they're not only unhappy with the result, but they feel they were disrespected, given the fact that this whole process started because of them, and they've been the lead group in trying to protect the Great Lakes and limit the amount of withdrawals.
And the proposal the mayors offered was flatly rejected by the council.
It was dissected and then rejected, correct. Why these things were dissected and not utilized, we just simply think that that was the will of the governors at the time. The change really is that, you know, the majority of those governors are gone. And so we look forward to working with a new team that may be looking differently on this.
John Dickert, president of the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Cities Initiative. Thank you so much for speaking with us, John.
Thank you for your time.
Coming up, last week, Michigan State University officials announced they're shutting down the $10 million fund the university set up to help victims of disgraced sports doctor Larry Nassar. That means there are therapists who are out thousands of dollars in services they've already provided. After the break, we talk with someone whose job it is to help these therapists get paid. That's in 10 minutes. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. One in three. That's the number of Detroit properties that have gone through tax foreclosure in the past 15 years. Foreclosure numbers have gone down sharply in the past couple of years. But as Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick reports, that drop hides chronic problems lurking under the surface.
I talked with Kiara Clark at her house on Detroit's east side back in September.
I love this home. Like, I got this home when I was pregnant with him.
That's her now 2-year-old son, Caden, you hear in the background. During the summer, she found out the house was in tax foreclosure and going up for auction.
This was a nightmare. You know, I'm paying rent to someone that lost a home and is in foreclosure.
A few years ago, her house would probably have been one of many on the block headed to auction. As of right now, 20 more properties on her block alone are behind on their taxes. But their owners have all found some way to stay out of foreclosure, for now. Most are on payment plans to get current on taxes. And the Wayne County Treasurer has started exempting more properties from the auction. That's great news for residents who don't want to lose their homes, but it masks an ongoing tax delinquency problem that could explode in the coming years.
We've been sweeping this problem under the rug.
That's Alexa Eisenberg. She's a doctoral student at the University of Michigan.
When you're, you know, talking to people, when you're actually looking at it more holistically, the crisis is basically the same as it was before.
Wayne County collects delinquent property taxes for Detroit. When tax foreclosures in Detroit hit crisis levels about 6 years ago, the county started putting people on payment plans. The county treasurer also started exercising more discretion, allowing some properties to bypass the auction. Here's Treasurer Eric Sabree in a video ad.
Keep your payments current, especially if you have an interest reduction agreement, which allows you to pay 6% interest per year. If you default, your interest payments will increase to 18% per year.
Payment plans are supposed to be a solution, but when people really can't afford their taxes, they usually can't afford their payment plans either, and they put some people into a deeper hole than they started off in. Alexa Eisenberg says tax distress is still a chronic problem, and the foreclosure pipeline isn't any less full. It's just stopped up for the moment.
Putting people onto payment plans and having them more gradually fall off or get back on, or kind of change the rules on an annual basis of who can be foreclosed upon and who can't, is an effective way of making those numbers come down.
Right now, around 65,000 Detroit properties are behind on their property taxes.
So to me, that indicates, of course, that it's not a personal problem. This is a systemic problem.
Laura Graneman is with the Quicken Loans Community Fund. That's the philanthropic arm of Detroit billionaire Dan Gilbert's various companies. Graneman says a new consensus has emerged over the past couple years. Auctioning off mass numbers of foreclosed properties has been devastating.
It's created blight, it's created displacement, it's created human hardship. So many different problems emanate from that one challenge of property tax foreclosure.
Their outreach shows that few people knew about a key Detroit program that would attack the root cause of tax distress. It's a property tax exemption program for the lowest income households.
Playing the catch-up game is a real struggle. Just all the back bills, the water bill, the taxes, everything that could fall on a house was on a house in the thousands.
Robin Davidson inherited her Detroit home from her grandfather, but it had back property taxes attached. Davidson got on a payment plan and set to work methodically paying them off, but she fell off her plan when a medical issue forced her off work. Now she's hoping a property tax exemption will give her some breathing room to deal with that debt while she gets back on her feet.
I'm like, okay, I'm not going to lose the house. I mean, it's a family home. It's a nice home, nice area. I could see me being there for a good little minute.
But the property tax exemption program isn't retroactive. That means a lot of low-income people are stuck paying off back property taxes, often taxes they weren't legally required to pay in the first place. And many people who already lost their homes are now renters. So they're vulnerable to landlords who don't pay their property taxes. Remember Kiara Clark and that home she really didn't want to leave? It sold in the first round of this year's tax auction for $18,000. I'm Sarah Swick, Michigan Radio News.
Last week, Michigan State University announced it will not reopen its Healing Assistance Fund. That's the fund set up to pay for counseling and other services for survivors of sexual abuse committed by former MSU sports doctor Larry Nassar. He, of course, is spending the rest of his life in prison. This $10 million fund was frozen in July because MSU officials had concerns over fraud. Our next guest says MSU owes therapists in the Lansing region thousands and thousands of dollars for services they've already provided, and it is not clear how or if they will be reimbursed. Tamara Legallo is CEO of The Support Group. It's a small business that offers billing services for mental health professionals in the Lansing area. She also owns a therapy practice. Welcome, Tamara. What was your first reaction when you heard that MSU was shutting down the Healing Assistance Fund?
Initially, I was not surprised. However, it quickly came with anger and frustration.
Why?
So for both sides, both for the clients and for the therapist in our community under good faith have provided services beyond July when the Nassar Fund was frozen for continuity of care for their clients. Freezing it for fraud, you know, we were understanding, but these clients and clinicians have established relationships. Sexual assault is not something you just go to counseling once or twice for and you're all better. I'm a victim of sexual assault and I've been in counseling, you know, for years and I'm still working through things. So I'm empathetic in that area. For the clients, I feel like they're being re-victimized. You know, MSU puts out this fund. They're going to help you. They're going to support you through this. And now they just kind of rip it away. On the side of the therapist, in good faith, they continue providing treatment. To have the fund, you know, frozen, you know, we all kind of shook our heads. But then to know that they're just not going to get paid or likely not to get paid was really, really frustrating. In all of our contacts with the fund, it was, we're just doing an investigation, keep submitting your claims, you know, so forth. And now all of a sudden, you know, the therapists have one of two options.
Well, let me back up a little first before we do all of that. What was the process? Explain the process set up for therapists to get paid by MSU from the Healing Assistance Fund.
So the process, or lack thereof process, you know, when a client would come in and initiate that they were part of the Nassar Fund, we would submit invoices over to an attorney who then would pay them. And I say that loosely because we've not yet been paid for any of them. There was not a real process, and that's where it's kind of frustrating. and probably why there's, you know, questionable fraud and things like that. They didn't give us a concrete process. Like, you know, your client's going to come in with this form, utilize this form to get payment. It was submit the invoice and we'll pay it, which doesn't seem like a valid control of a fund worth $10 million.
All right. So we understand. How many therapists do you work with who have been seeing NASSAR survivors, people who expect to be reimbursed by MSU?
I work with 4, and then I'm pretty heavily connected in the mental health community. I'm aware of 10 in the community currently that are in that boat of questionable if they will or will not get paid.
Were the therapists paid for services that were delivered prior to July when the fund was frozen?
We have not received payment for services prior to the fund being frozen. However, the invoices have been submitted. I have made several contacts with the person responsible for allocating those funds, and I've gotten no response. So
you're working with these 4 therapists. How much unpaid money are we talking about that's still outstanding?
It's over $30,000 when I did a quick, you know, calculation this morning, and it could be more.
And what are therapists hearing when they ask MSU what's going on? What's MSU saying back?
Currently, I don't know that any of the therapists have had communication with MSU. I had some brief communication shared with me that some of the claims that were submitted prior to the fund being frozen may or may not be paid out. However, they've been accumulating since July, so there's many claims that haven't been submitted that are in limbo, and we're unsure what to do with those at this moment.
Are you getting any answers to the email inquiries you're sending? I mean, is it just radio silence, or are you hearing something like, well, we'll look into it and get back to you?
There are no answers. I have several unresponded emails. I have reached out a number of times asking if they would like me to do something differently, if they would like them submitted somewhere differently, and I have gotten 0 response.
When you're not getting answers, you don't have a billing process from MSU, you're not getting a lot of information, it sounds as though these therapists that you work with are doing the work based on good faith.
They are doing the work based on good faith. That's the exact term that I use. Treating these clients, continuing with their relationships with them, building trust, you know, processing this trauma that these survivors have endured, and they don't want to re-victimize them by coming around and saying, oh, by the way, you owe me thousands of dollars. So it's a really tough position for the clinicians to be in, and also for the survivors. I mean, we're just kind of feeling stuck. We don't know what to do. And it's frustrating. It's really, really frustrating.
Are these clinicians willing to keep providing counseling and therapy services even though they're not getting paid?
The therapists that I work with directly are going to continue treating their clients. Ethically, they feel bound to. They can't abandon their clients. They've established relationships. Some survivors come to treatment twice a week. Some come once a week. I mean, they're dependent on this treatment, and they've established this relationship. If they can't afford it, then we'll have to figure something out in the future, but we're not going to just walk away from them.
Now, an MSU spokesperson told the Lansing State Journal last week when this news came out that the $10 million fund was set up to be a bridge to offer survivors financial support until the settlement was reached. And she said any claims made prior to when the account was frozen back in July will be honored, which is what you've heard as well. But what does this all mean for you or to you?
Well, this means to me that that's great up until June or July, but from July forward, we're just out of luck. I mean, that's the way it sounds to me. When they froze the fund, they made no inclination that it would disappear or that those claims would go unpaid. I feel like they've handled it just like a PR stunt, personally. I mean, it was all to look good in the news and on the paper. Here, let us help you. And now we've given you money, so go pay for your health care on your own. you know, if you're in an auto accident and you get money for pain and suffering and then you get your medical bills paid, I feel like, you know, in this sense, it's here's your settlement, but also go pay for all of your health care at the same time.
So I guess what can you do? What's the next step for you?
The next step for us, I think I'm trying to coordinate with some of the local clinicians so we can discuss it. There's been talk about, you know, suing MSU for the remainder of the balances, trying to put forth something going forward. I feel that it would have been more appropriate for MSU to not retroactive the termination of the fund, but maybe to set forth effective, you know, December 31st, the fund will close and we'll pay any claims in this portion. That would have given ample time for the clinicians to speak with the clients, to do a transfer of care if necessary, and to, you know, abide by their ethical obligations as well. So I think we're all just trying to wrap our heads around it and make a plan. I truly, at this moment, I don't think any of us know exactly what we're going to do. It's going to be a case-by-case basis, too, of course. Some of the survivors, you know, simply it was a copay. It was like $20 a session. But some of the survivors, it's $120 a session because of a high deductible or things like that. And it really takes longer time to address that and make a plan.
Well, that is Tamara Legallo, who is CEO of The Support Group. This is a business offering billing services and support for mental health professionals in the Lansing area. Thank you so much for speaking with us, Tamara.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you speaking out for us and on behalf of the survivors.
We reached out to Michigan State University requesting a comment on this story. We did not hear back. Unlike most of Larry Nassar's victims, Kyle Stevens was not his patient. She was the daughter of a close family friend. Starting when she was just 6 years old, Nassar sexually abused Kyle during family get-togethers at his house. When Kyle finally told her parents, they didn't believe her. Her father especially continued to defend Nassar, and so Kyle distanced herself from him. But then in 2008, she saw a shift. Here's a clip from this week's episode of Believed.
Kyle is 18 years old. She's getting ready to go off to college. She and her dad are at it again.
I got in a fight with my dad, and he pulled the same card. He said, you never apologize to Larry. And I realized I'm leaving for college in a month. This guy has no more power over me. He can't do anything to my life anymore.
So for the first time since she was a kid, Kyle tells her dad the truth. I wasn't lying about Larry. Kyle says her dad gets right up in her face.
And said, what did you say? And I said, I wasn't lying. He just crumpled onto the couch and just stared in his face. I think it just the weight of everything was just crashing over him. And he said, what did he do? And I said, I'm not ready to talk about that. Not with you. And he respected that, and I went off to college and we didn't talk.
You can hear this finale of Believed on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcast. The epilogue of Believed will air next Monday. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, April Van Buren, Sam Corey, Joey Horan, Sarah Leeson, Bella Isaacs, and Natalie Brennan. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.